I next met with Dr. Richard Goldberg for his take on progress or lack of it in clinical research in colorectal cancer, and to explore that from the perspective of the oncologist in clinical practice, Dr. Goldberg presented several patients he treated in his practice, beginning with a young man with recurrent rectal cancer.
This is a case of a 49-year-old man with a T2N0 low rectal cancer that I met after he had a local recurrence. He initially had a laparoscopic resection 3 years before I met him. At the time I met him, he had a staging PET scan that showed hot regional nodes along the iliacs, but also in the right inguinal region. He got FOLFOX plus BEV for 12 cycles, ended up with neuropathy, and his disease stabilized. And so we faced the issue here of whether we ought to just continue with chemotherapy in this individual, or should we consider a more aggressive local therapy because all he appeared to have was nodal disease.
Let's go back over what happened prior to that point. When he was treated initially, did he have an ultrasound, endorectal ultrasound?
He actually was treated at another institution, but I believe that he did have a rectal ultrasound.
And he was considered T2N0. What about the issue of neoadjuvant therapy or postoperative therapy in a patient like that?
Well, it's always hard to know nowadays whether to give someone preoperative therapy. And in general, our approach is that we do endorectal ultrasound on everybody. If the patient has T3 disease or higher, or any positive lymph nodes, then we generally will treat them preoperatively with chemotherapy and radiation. If they're a T2N0, as this individual was, this is a person that we would consider doing upfront surgery. There's data from Len Gunderson, published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology several years ago, that looked at an analysis of a number of rectal adjuvant trials. And what it showed was that patients with T2N0 disease had a very low incidence of local recurrence, and one could consider sparing them radiation because of the long-term toxicities, the clustering of bowel movements and nocturnal bowel movements, and the frequency that those patients have. So this patient was treated just with resection with no preoperative or postoperative therapy, and that isn't an unreasonable thing to do in that circumstance.
I guess I'm just bringing this up because of the fact that he does have local recurrence. Do you think that if he'd gotten neoadjuvant chemoradiation or post-op chemoradiation, he would likely have still had local recurrence?
Well, it's a very interesting question. One would be tempted to say that he might not have. And that in retrospect, we wish we'd have given him that, but I wasn't seeing him at that time.
Do you know what the pathology showed? And how do you make a determination in a patient like that once they've had surgery, whether or not to give them post-op treatment?
In someone who's had preoperative chemo and radiation, what we more or less tell them is, if we're going that route, then we're going to plan to give you post-operative chemotherapy because we can no longer stage you accurately after you've had the preoperative chemo radiation. In someone who is taken to the operating room initially, then we're totally guided by the pathology. If they had positive nodes or if they had a T4 tumor, then we would consider postoperative therapy. But for a T2 like this, we probably would opt not to give postoperative therapy.
And when you say postoperative therapy, you're saying chemo or chemo radiation?
I'm saying both. So, you know, for T1 lesions, there's very good data that you can even do local resection and have a very high cure rate. For T2 lesions, that data isn't as strong, and we would not manage those patients with local resection without either an APR or an LAR because they have a much higher risk of local recurrence with a regional-only procedure.
So the first time you saw him was when he had locally recurrent disease.
Right.
Now, at that point, did he have any tumor-related symptoms?
No, he was feeling fine, fully active.
And what about the possibility of incorporating radiation therapy? Did you consider that up front?
You know, I actually saw him at the point where he had had 12 cycles of BEV.
I see.
Where he had a minimal response to the BEV, had developed some neuropathy, and was then going around the country getting expert opinions about what he should do next.
So at the point that he was treated with a full FOX BEV, in retrospect, do you think that radiation should have been considered also?
this was sort of that orderly series of let's get a maximum tumor response using chemotherapy and then bring in the local modalities, either radiation or surgery or both. And so this actually ended up with a difference of opinion between two people that are considered, or two teams of people at NCI-designated cancer centers. What our approach at UNC was to recommend to him that he get external beam radiotherapy and then go to the OR and get IORT and resection and follow that up with some additional chemotherapy. And our thinking in this was that he had localized disease. If this had been a retroperitoneal recurrence in a patient with colon cancer, that's the approach we would have taken. There is some data, again, from Gunderson et al. When he was at Mayo Clinic, that you can cure some patients with lymph node-limited recurrences using this aggressive approach, and that's what we recommended to him. He ended up opting for the opinion from the other center, which was, let's do some more chemotherapy to see if we can reduce the disease. And, you know, I just recently heard from him again. Unfortunately, he developed metastatic disease in his lungs and has a lymphangitic pattern and is pretty symptomatic right now. So, unfortunately, this good prognosis tumor is going to end up taking this fellow's life.
What were you thinking about in presenting him? What do you think the message here is?
Well, the message from my perspective is that some people with local regional nodal recurrence can be salvaged with an aggressive approach. And, you know, one of our fine points in managing patients with colorectal cancer is, are we aggressive or are we palliative in managing them? And more, I think we're able to cure people by being aggressive, either using hepatic resection, using multiple agent chemotherapy with resection, and factoring in both radiation and intraoperative radiation. And granted, you're pushing the envelope on this, but, you know, this was a 49-year-old fellow with no other medical problems who wanted to take an aggressive approach.
Has he had any local symptoms up to this point?
He's never had local symptoms from his recurrent disease.
What would you generally expect in terms of local symptomatology with disease where he had it in terms of the lymph nodes and inguinal area and the, I guess, regional retroperitoneal area?
You know, you obviously could worry about lymphedema of the lower extremity. I have one patient with a similar presentation that has a syndrome like myalgia paresthetica where she has a numb leg because of pressure on the sensory nerves coming through the inguinal canal. You also could get a potentially arterial compression as well, although that would be less common. Of course, the miserable recurrences in rectal cancer are the ones that are presacral, where the tumors grow into the sacral nerve roots and cause miserable pain and disability.
How often nowadays do we see local recurrence in rectal cancer?
We're seeing it less and less common, and it certainly depends on the initial stage of disease. So for individuals with T4 tumors or individuals with N2 tumors, four or more positive nodes, the risk of local recurrence is still relatively high. If you take all comers, for instance, in the Dutch colorectal trial, they only had about a 9% local recurrence rate. But for the high-stage, high-risk patients, I would estimate it to be closer to 30%.
You know, as I look over this case, it seems like there are two things. Either this patient had a very unusual type of situation where he got the correct therapy, but it just didn't work, at least in terms of local recurrence. Or maybe somewhere along the line, there was some kind of break in protocol in terms of how he was managed. Maybe it wasn't really a T2 lesion. And I'm just trying to figure out why this occurred in an age where we think we can prevent this from happening.
Well, I think it may just illustrate the heterogeneity of colon and rectal cancers. It's interesting, the American Joint Commission on Cancer is holding their 50th anniversary meeting this year, and it's entitled Molecular Staging of Colon Cancer. I think the point of that is that anatomic staging gives us a certain amount of information, but it may be molecular staging that's going to make the difference in these lower risk patients on who we treat and who we don't. And of course, that's what the ECOG 5202 trial is trying to look at, a stage 2 colon cancer adjuvant study where patients with node-negative tumors have their 18q and MSI status evaluated, and only the high-risk patients are randomized to chemotherapy or chemotherapy bevacizumab.
And then, I guess, relevant to the issue of rectal cancer also are the two papers that were presented at ASCO looking at neoadjuvant chemoradiation therapy that include oxaliplatin. Can you comment on that?
Well, I think we were all disappointed by those results. Well, there was good data in phase two studies, including one that we ran in CLGB that Dave Ryan was the principal investigator on, that showed complete remission rates after preoperative 5-FU-oxali and radiation in the mid-20% range. And with 5-FU alone, you expect that to be somewhere between 10 and 15%. But in these two studies that were both large randomized trials, there was no advantage in the complete remission rate, the pathologically negative specimens, or in the nodal status. And so this was a pretty disappointing finding. I see a number of patients for second opinion consultations whose physicians have already adopted the strategy of adding oxaliplatin to 5-FU as a radiation sensitizer. And I think that this is pretty strong data that that should not be considered outside the context of a clinical trial. We, of course, will have the NSABP R04 study that's looking at that question as well. So we'll have another big data set to help confirm or refute those findings.
What about biologics and rectal cancer, particularly in terms of neoadjuvant chemoradiation therapy? What do we know about that?
Well, we know that there's data that Chris Willett has published looking at bevacizumab. And it's very interesting data because they gave single-agent bevacizumab and looked at interstitial fluid pressures on patients just getting that drug and saw that those fluid pressures fell, presumably meaning that you get better perfusion of the tumor, better distribution of chemotherapy when bevacizumab is added to 5-FU. We've only seen phase one and a little bit of phase two data with bevacizumab in that setting. And so, you know, I certainly would not recommend that as an off-study approach. We also have the interesting data that cetuximab is an effective radiation sensitizer in head and neck cancer, and wonder if that can be applied to rectal cancer, the other end of the aerodigestive tract. Those studies are in progress, but I'm not aware of any data on them yet.
Any other research strategies in rectal cancer that are being discussed right now?
Well, the American College of Surgeons is doing a big study looking at laparoscopic versus open rectal resection. And that mirrors the COST trial that Heidi Nelson ran years ago for colon cancer that showed the two are equivalent procedures. I think the other interesting studies in rectal cancer are looking at biopsies of the tumor to try and use biomarkers such as ERCC1 levels or TS levels to try and help to prospectively choose drugs as radiation sensitizers so that you can try and take the biologic characteristics of the tumor and choose among the drugs that we now have in our armamentarium based on the biology. But again, that's certainly the stuff of cancer center trials and not of clinical practice for the moment.
Let's talk about your 89-year-old patient.
Okay, so this was the mother of a faculty member at UNC who presented when she was 89 years old with a cecal cancer. Actually, a year before, she had come in and had been found to be anemic, and she and her son and the physician that was managing her decided she was too old to go through a workup for a cecal cancer. But then a year later, she was still plugging along. She walked with a walker because of arthritis, but she was active, got to the senior center every day, did pool aerobics every day, and now she had constant right lower quadrant pain that required palliative intervention.
What was the thinking about why she was anemic a year before?
Well, she had a positive guaiac, so the thought was that she probably had something going on in her colon. But the thinking was, you know, she's 88 years old, and does she really want to go through an operation and what comes to pass after that? And they made a different decision then than they did when she was symptomatic. And I think actually her son, the physician, had a lot of reservations about the decision they'd made when she was 88. She had mild hypertension and was on a beta blocker for that. But when I walked in the room to meet her for the first time, she was busy doing the New York Times crossword puzzle and, you know, was a very alert and engaging woman. So, you know, in this sort of circumstance, you make a decision, well, am I going to do anything? Because at the time that she had her resection, she had peritoneal disease, which we couldn't image, but which was seen by the surgeon. She wasn't symptomatic at that time, and she was still 89. So we talked it over, and we decided that she did want to get treatment. So initially, what I did was to start her out with just some infusional 5-FU, leucovorin, and bevacizumab. And I did that because the 5-FU leucovorin in that approach gives almost no toxicity, at least in my experience. The worst toxicity is having to have the port placed and carry the pump around. And we knew from the data from the Hurwitz trial and the Cabinovar trial that 5-FU, leucovorin, bevacizumab was effective as a regimen for treating advanced disease.
What did they see histologically or in the surgical specimen that was removed in terms of the depth of penetration and nodes?
So this was node positive, and it actually was a T4 tumor, and her right lower quadrant pain was, I think, because of invasion into the pelvic sidewall.
Now, did she have that pain post-op?
She didn't, and they were able actually to do an on-block resection of the disease with negative margins.
So the thinking was that she still had residual disease, though?
Well, it was clear that she had residual peritoneal disease that they did not resect at the time of surgery, but it was not bulky disease.
Now, since she was asymptomatic and 89 years old, did you consider holding off on systemic therapy?
Sure, I gave her that choice. You know, my experience has been that I'm more comfortable holding off on patients who have minimal asymptomatic diseases in the liver or the lung, but that peritoneal disease, often the first time that it becomes symptomatic is when it becomes symptomatic causing a bowel obstruction. And that obviously is pretty problematic. You either end up having to take that patient to the OR and do palliative bypasses, or they go right to hospice because I, and I think most oncologists, are not really comfortable treating obstructed patients with chemotherapy.
Now, you elected not to give her oxaliplatin, or I don't know, did you discuss that with her, or you just felt like that was not something that should be done?
Well, it's interesting. I felt like, on balance, we were taking a pretty aggressive approach using 5-FU leucovorin and Bev. And she already was walking with the walker, although she didn't have any sensory neuropathy. That mobility was important to her because she lived independently. And that went into my choice to not offer that at that time.
How did she do on the therapy?
Well, she did tolerate the therapy quite well. She did notice that her proliferative retinitis got better on the bevacizumab, which, of course, we didn't really know was the case back when I treated her. She was treated a few years ago. I'm not sure that her disease ever shrunk because we couldn't evaluate it. She was on the 5-FU leucovorin and Bev for about 6 months. I had to add a second drug to control her hypertension, but with that, she maintained her lifestyle and her enjoyment of life during that time.
What happened?
Well, she subsequently had progressive disease, and I added oxaliplatin at that point.
Wow.
And she didn't tolerate that well. We ended up seeing progressive disease, and she had a local recurrence in the incision site.
But you kept the 5-FU and Bev going?
Right. I just added the oxali to that regimen. She had progression pretty rapidly, took a month off to go back to Buffalo to celebrate her 90th birthday with her family. And then when she came back, we actually put her on irinotecan plus cetuximab. And she tolerated that poorly, but not, you know, with dramatic bad effects.
What kind of problems did she have?
She had fatigue and she had some diarrhea. So I would say that that experiment was not a major success.
You had a KRAS on her, or that was before the KRAS?
That was before the KRAS data. Her main progressive disease manifestation was a fairly large subcutaneous nodule that started to erupt through the skin. So we radiated her at that point, and then she went on to hospice management at that point. The point of this case really is to illustrate that just because someone's 89 doesn't mean you should say to them right away, go to hospice. You know, she lived about 16 months with this high-risk disease. The data would suggest that most people who are not treated at all live about 6 months. And so I think that this had a positive impact on her and that her management went as she directed it with my advice.
Now, the only Bev-related problem this lady had was hypertension?
Right. She was really pleased that her vision improved while she was on the bevacizumab.
Interesting. And what is your observation, and what do we know in general about bevacizumab in older patients in terms of acute side effects and toxicity and also arteriovenous events?
Well, there was data published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute that showed that individuals above the age of 65 have a higher risk of vascular events, but it's only 3% versus 1 or 2%. Unless they've had an arterial thrombotic event such as a stroke, angina, a TIA, or a heart attack, in which case their risk of a vascular complication goes up. Now, this woman had never had that. That is a question that I ask, and you know, I still have treated people who I know have coronary artery disease if they've got stents in place and aren't having angina with bevacizumab. So, you know, I think it's one of those things that you need to factor into your equation, but it isn't something that automatically disqualifies a patient, in my opinion.
How about your older man with 16 positive nodes?
So, you know, yesterday in clinic, I saw a 76-year-old. His son is an administrator at a cancer center, so knowledgeable about cancer and connected. And he had 16 of 17 positive lymph nodes. Has had 3 stents placed in his coronary arteries, but, you know, is an active guy golfing and walking 2 miles a day and so on. So, you know, we sat there and reflected, do we give you just 5-FU leucovorin based on the Mayer Heart data, or do we give you FOLFOX? And I ended up trying to take an intermediate approach to him. I said, let's give you 5-FU leucovorin using the Degremont style infusion for 2 treatments and see how you're doing, and then we'll decide whether we're going to add oxaliplatin or not. Now, you could argue in a guy like this that you're not treating him really for adjuvant disease. You're treating him for advanced disease because he had 15 or 16 positive lymph nodes. But, you know, I lean toward being aggressive in these patients because I think we can get more from multi-agent chemotherapy than we can get from single-agent chemotherapy.
So where is that patient right now?
Next week, he's going to get a port place and he's going to get started on 5-FU leucovorin.
If he asked you, or if maybe he did ask you, what would you say the theoretical risk of recurrence would be?
Well, if you go back to the data from the Gill analysis that was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology back in the late 90s, and I was a co-author on that, patients who have T4 tumors, and he had a T4 tumor, and N2 disease have an exceedingly high likelihood of recurrence. So they really only have about a 10% cure rate with no chemotherapy alone. And in the Gill analysis, we were just looking at 5-FU at that time. They had the biggest benefit in terms of the difference between the likelihood of recurrence without chemotherapy versus chemotherapy. So I would estimate with chemotherapy, his cure rate is maybe 20%. But you've still got the odds stacked against you in this circumstance.
How about your 39-year-old woman?
So this is a young woman who presented with bowel obstruction and at the time of her presentation had massive liver metastases with a liver that was palpable about 8 centimeters below the costal margin in the midclavicular line, CEA over 300. You know, one of those CT scans that you look at and you say, oh gosh, this isn't going to go very well.
How did she present?
She presented with bowel obstruction symptoms. But, you know, 39 years old, everybody was pretty surprised at what was going on. And this was a right-sided colon lesion, so she'd obviously had it for a while, and nobody thought of colon cancer. So we treated her on the 80405 protocol, and she was randomized to the control arm of FOLFOX plus Bev.
Could you just go through the design of that study?
Sure. So the design of that study is in evolution. So the design at the time that she went on was FOLFOX plus Bev, FOLFOX plus cetuximab, or both. And this was prior to the time that we knew about KRAS mutations. Now the study is in the process of being changed again. Only patients with KRAS wild-type tumors are eligible. And the randomization is just going to be 2 arms, FOLFOX plus Bev versus FOLFOX plus cetuximab. And the reason for that is that, you know, we now have the data that double antibody modulation seems to be at best not helpful and at worst actually harmful in some patients. So she went on that study, and interestingly enough, within 5 days of getting treatment, she was admitted to the hospital with severe right upper quadrant pain. And we thought, oh, no, she's perforated. Because, of course, she'd had a recent surgery. Turned out that wasn't what happened. She had such an incredible response to the chemotherapy that she developed liver capsule irritation and had pain on the basis of a necrotic tumor.
Wow. What did the scan look like?
So, you know, the scan initially showed a lot of edema, and then her disease just melted away.
Hmm.
And she was on this treatment then for about 14 months after that. And her CEA actually got down to normal. You know, she was perfectly functional, although she began to develop a little bit of oxaliplatin-related neurotoxicity, and we had to reduce her dose, but never did stop the oxaliplatin.
How'd she do on the Bev?
No problems at all with the Bev.
As long as you're talking about the neuropathy, did you use calcium and magnesium at that point? And what are you doing today after ASCO?
Well, I'm somebody who's in the cautious camp about calcium and magnesium, and I don't often use it. I honestly don't feel that you get that much incremental oxaliplatin into people by using the calcium and magnesium. It certainly increases the chair time for patients. This woman was a young mother who came from a distance and wanted to put her kids on the school bus and be back when her kids got off the school bus, and so it would have been hard to add the time for her infusion. So I tend not to use the calcium and magnesium. The setting where I will use it is a setting like this, if someone wants it, where I'm treating somebody who isn't ever going to be a candidate for surgery and therefore is getting palliative therapy. So she had a great response and really a normal performance score and was able to play tennis and keep up with her kids' schedules. But eventually, like happens in virtually everybody in this circumstance, her CEA bumped up again. Now, interestingly, the bump in her CEA preceded any change in her CT scan. And one of the things that I find in the age of biologics is that CT scans are less reliable than they used to be as a way of judging things. And I've seen in some cases scans look much worse when people are responding to therapy, when they're getting 5-FU-BEV.
What do you think's going on there?
Well, I think they're getting edema, and I think you're changing isodense lesions into lesions that are more easily visible. We actually did a case report on a patient that we saw that's in clinical colorectal cancer, where the patient's CT scan was read as worse, but his pain had gotten better and his CEA had come down, and we show serial CT scans that show a dramatic improvement in his scan over time. And then the other thing is that I think that as these tumors start to escape from control with FOLFOX and BEV, that sometimes a CAT scan lags behind the CEA in terms of showing that evidence of disease. Now, this patient was on a clinical protocol, and the protocol said you had to see an increase in the size of the lesions rather than an increase in the CEA to call progression, and we followed the protocol.
What was the magnitude of the CEA increase?
Well, it went from normal, so less than 5, up tenfold to about 50. So, you know, I was pretty suspicious that her disease was escaping control at that point. And then finally, we got a CAT scan that showed that her liver disease was progressing. You know, when I first met her, I would guess that 70% of her liver was replaced. At this point, she only really had about 10% of her liver replaced with disease. And she said that, you know, the thing I hate most about having cancer is my colostomy. And so we talked it over, and she said, you know, I understand that my disease is growing, but from a quality of life perspective, I want to get rid of it. And so we did. And she did fine, although her liver lesions were bigger on the new baseline study that we did after she had recovered from the colostomy. And we put her on panitumumab and irinotecan.
Again, did you have KRAS for her?
We did have KRAS for her, and she was KRAS wild type.
And just to clarify for our listeners why you use panitumumab as opposed to the cetuximab?
Well, we live in the anaphylaxis belt.
Right.
So there's an area that goes across North Carolina, Tennessee, and into the Midwest where it appears that the incidence of reactions to the mouse monoclonal cetuximab is higher than is reported in the rest of the world. So the rest of the world reports a 1% to 2% anaphylaxis rate. In our clinic, 1 out of every 3 patients we give cetuximab to ends up with a severe reaction. And we've not had anybody have severe reactions to panitumumab. So unless we're putting a patient on study, we generally use Arino panitumumab.
And anything new in terms of the pathophysiology of why you see the geographic area? And also there was a blood test that was being developed to try to identify these patients.
Right. There is a blood test being developed. There was a paper by Christine Chen that was in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed that there's actually a measurable antibody, which is a sugar on the cell surface that can predict for this response. And Bristol-Myers and ImClone have been looking into this with experts in anaphylaxis and have actually identified the possibility that this is related to some sort of cross-immunogenicity due to insect bite exposure. And they're still working on that story, but it's a fascinating story. They are still trying to develop this blood test. We would certainly consider using this blood test in any patient that we were going to use cetuximab in, but in New York City or in Boston or in other places in the world, if all you're looking for is to rule out a 1% to 3% likelihood of a severe reaction, you might not order that test.
What's your experience been with panitumumab, both in terms of efficacy, side effects, and how it compares to what's reported in the literature?
Our experience has been pretty good, and I would suspect that we use more panitumumab than the average center for the reasons I've described. You know, we see the same skin reactions. We are using the so-called STEP trial results, which Edith Mitchell has presented at ASCO. So we're using prophylactic tetracycline or doxycycline skin creams for moisturizing and prophylactic sunscreens. And I think that that makes a difference with the skin toxicity. As I said, we have not seen any severe allergic reactions to panitumumab. And my sense is that the activity level we're seeing is pretty much identical to what we're used to seeing with irinotecan cetuximab.
So what happened with this woman?
Well, she's had another great response, and her CEA has come back down into the normal range. Her liver lesions are shrinking. And, you know, it was interesting. I saw her in clinic, and I looked at her CT scan, and the measurable size of the lesions in the liver hadn't changed that dramatically, but the consistency, the amount of contrast that those lesions took up had changed. And I said to her, I don't know what your CEA is yet, because I was seeing her in the morning and our CEAs run in the afternoon, but I'm going to bet it's going to be way better than it was. And I think that the change that I see on your CT scan is much more dramatic in terms of what's happened to the biology of your disease than what's happened to the measurable size of your disease, which is a pretty interesting thing because, of course, you know, we use all these RECIST criteria to tell whether drugs are working or not. And just like with sorafenib and hepatocellular cancer, measurement of lesions may not be as reliable as an indicator of biologic response as it used to be.
So what was her CEA?
So her CEA after three treatments went down to about 8, and that's where she is now. So I haven't seen a repeat after three treatments.
How's she doing in terms of dermatologic issues?
She's got them. So she, you know, was given the advice to use the prophylactic antibiotics and the skin creams, and she was not particularly compliant about it. And she's a woman for whom appearance is important. So now she looks like a pimply teenager, unfortunately.
What's the distribution of the lesions?
Face and trunk, so basically upper chest, both on the front and the back.
How do you approach management?
In my experience, using antibiotics, prophylactic cyclins, does matter. I also think that the dermatologic manifestations tend to peak within about 6 weeks of starting the drug in the patients who get it. If you can tide people through it, a lot of times the skin manifestations get better. Now, in my experience, the nail manifestations and the paronychiae get worse despite the skin getting better. But I have found that if I stop the treatment for a month in patients, that oftentimes the angry reactions will subside, and when you restart, you don't get quite as much of a reaction.
What's it take for you to change the dose or hold off on the medicine?
It takes the patient saying, this is unacceptable to me.
What do you see in the future for this woman? She's obviously unusual, and she's had a response to two chemobiologic regimens. What are you thinking about for your next move?
Boy, that's a tough question. So, you know, I guess one question is, in somebody who had such a great response to FOLFOX, would she ever become responsive again to FOLFOX?
FOLFOX or FOLFOX Bev.
Right, or FOLFOX Bev. And, you know, Amory Degremont had a little bit of data on that at this year's ASCO, where he looked at the patients in the Optimox trials that his group has run. And the longer the interval between first oxaliplatin and restarting oxaliplatin, the more likely the patient was to respond. Now, those patients didn't become refractory like she did, and so it's a little bit hard to extrapolate what that data means to her. I have retreated a few patients with FOLFOX who have progressed on it and then had 2 or 3 years interval before they ran out of other options. And I've had a few anecdotal responses in that circumstance. So I think that there may be some tumors where the chemotherapy resistance in the face of new chemotherapy drugs modulates again and the tumor can become more sensitive. The other obvious thing is that there are many different trials going on now with new agents, new antibodies to insulin-like growth factors, new small molecules, and so our phase one program is loaded with studies that would be of potential interest to her. But all in all, she's, you know, a 39-year-old woman with 3 kids who is not going to survive this brush with cancer.
What's it been like taking care of her for you?
It's been a challenge. You know, she's very smart and interactive, and I've gotten to know her kids and her husband pretty well. And she's done some public affairs events promoting clinical trials, which she was on, and promoting living hard despite living with cancer. And so, you know, we're attached to all our patients, but we're attached to some patients more than others, and she would fit in that category.
You mentioned new agents, clinical trials. What do you have available right now at your place, and anything that you're looking out, kind of getting excited about?
Well, we have a bunch of studies with investigational agents. We've got one with the compound 2171, which is a multi-targeted drug. We've got an insulin-like growth factor antibody. We've got an anti-apoptotic agent, an Aurora kinase inhibitor. You know, there are just so many drugs out there that are interesting and which we're hopeful about. It's hard to know which of them will hit, and that still remains to be determined.
You mentioned 2171. That's cedirinib.
Right.
In the trial that you're involved with, what exactly is it looking at?
Well, we're seeing activity. It's coupled with irinotecan. It's hard to know whether the activity is additive because, of course, we don't have data yet except on our individual patients.
Now, this is a TKI targeting VEGF.
Right.
Or VEGFs.
Right, VEGFs, 1, 2, and 3. Plus, it also hits PDGF.
What do you see in terms of side effects and toxicity?
The usual plus a bit more fatigue, which I think is a class effect of the TKIs.
When you say the usual, you see Bev kinds of things, hypertension, proteinuria,
right.
Proteinuria
exactly.
Also?
I have not seen proteinuria in the patients I've managed. I'm not the PI of this trial, so I'm only seeing the patients I'm managing.
You mentioned this trial looking at irinotecan with this agent. What are the other types of trials that are looking at this?
Well, I think that they actually have a phase 3 first-line study going on, which is nearly accrued, so we will get some data from a large trial soon.
Now, is that the one looking at FOLFOX Bev versus FOLFOX 2171?
Yes.
Any data in terms of safety in that trial?
I haven't seen a safety analysis that I can remember.
You also mentioned the insulin growth factor receptor inhibitor. I'm starting to hear more about those agents in general, not just in colon cancer. What kind of agent is this, and what do we know about it?
Well, this whole insulin story in cancer is interesting and timely. As many people may know, you know, there was some recent studies in a diabetology journal that suggested that insulin glargine, or Lantus, was associated with an increased risk of cancers. And those studies have been fairly heavily criticized, and I'm sure that there'll be future studies to look at that as well. And of course, you know, body mass index has been associated with cancer, and hyperinsulinemia is often associated with increased body mass. And so it's hard to sort out how much of this is energy balance, how much of this is insulin, and how much of it is exogenous insulin. But there does seem to be data that suggests that insulin, like growth factors, play a role in cancer growth and metastases in many different diseases, breast cancer, colon cancer, and others. And obviously, a number of different pharmaceutical companies have identified this as a target and have developed drugs that hit it. Those studies are pretty early on in their progress at this point, so I don't know that we really have any data to know whether this theoretically promising approach is going to turn out to be actually useful.
Are these agents, they're antibodies, or what kind of?
Yes, they're antibodies.
Any issues in terms of side effects? You have, glucose problems?
You do get glucose problems, so these patients tend to get hyperglycemic, and you have to watch that and sometimes hit them with some insulin. That's interesting. I was reflecting back on what's going on in colorectal cancer, and it isn't clear what the next new cytotoxic is going to be. There are all these biologics and small molecule inhibitors that are coming along, but none of them seems to be the Michael Phelps of the biologics world that's clearly going to come in first. And so we seem to be sort of at a plateau for the moment, and we're all anxious to keep climbing the survival curve for our patients. But it isn't absolutely clear what strategies are going to lead us to do that.
That's a little discouraging.
Well, I think it's a temporary break. I don't think we've hit the ice age. It's not going to be a recession like the economic recession. It'll be briefer than that.